Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Are you thinking about saving for your child's education? It is a super, super smart thing to do. And there are a number of ways to do it. There's a self-directed option. There's also something called a scholarship trust. But there are some real cons to that approach. We want to have you understand the pros and cons before you go all in. Aravind Sitham Parapile is an associate at Ironwood Wealth Management, and he's going to talk about how those scholarship trusts work. Then the idea of retirement is changing. I mean, in so many ways, right? But one is longevity. Are we going to live much longer than our parents did? And what does that mean for our savings? Darren Coleman, senior portfolio manager at Coleman Wealth at Raymond James, and he says people could live to 150. A kid born today could live to 150. So how do you factor in that potential longevity into your financial plan? With high inflation, more and more people are considering themselves to be a Henry, a high earner, not rich yet. That's what that acronym stands for. So what does that mean? What does it mean in today's day and age to feel comfortable financially? Andy Smith is Executive Director of Financial Planning at Edelman Financial Engines, and he's going to talk more about what the term is and what it means for you. Plus, a car, buying a car, maintaining a car, insuring a car is a huge commitment for people, right? Now, if you only use it occasionally, or, you know, maybe you don't, want to stay with the same car for long periods of time, even leasing might seem like a huge responsibility. There is now something called a car subscription service. So it's not a car rental and it's not a car lease, it's a subscription. One company that offers this service is called Roam. Its founder and CEO, Apoorv Gupta, is here on the show today to talk about how it works. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. We have talked about RESPs on this show a lot. I'm a huge believer in RESPs. There's a guaranteed good time because of the government grant. I have a kid of my own. I've been doing it since they were born. And it matters how you actually take advantage of this government program. Not all RESPs are created equally. And so we're going to talk about that today. And the catalyst was a listener email talking about a not great experience that he had with something called a scholarship trust. So we're going to take a closer look at what those scholarship trusts are and some of the pros and cons. Our guest is Aravind Sitham Parapile. He is an associate at Ironwood Wealth Management, and he joins us now from Hamilton, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you doing today?
You have skin in the game. Three kids, is that right?
Yep, 7, 5, and 3. So okay. Literally.
You are in it. So as I said, RESPs, there's a government grant. It's a guaranteed 20% return. You can open one up almost anywhere, a bank, a credit union, a brokerage house, a discount brokerage, or you can set up something called a scholarship trust. Take us through exactly what a scholarship trust is.
Love it. Thank you. So a scholarship trust, or they are also called group RESPs, and as the group name implies, what happens is your money. So if I enrolled one of my kids into a scholarship trust, it's not just an RESP for my child. It's a group RESP for a whole bunch of people's children. And so Bruce, your child might be in there. Many of your listeners, well, one of your listeners is in there. And so all of that money is pooled together. And then the responsibility of managing or growing that pool of contributions is outsourced to this firm, this scholarship trust organization. And then they make the investment decisions on behalf of everyone who's contributed into it. You contribute.
In theory, it sounds great. It's like, yep. Oh my God, that's like insurance. That's like a mutual fund. And it's not so great. There are some cons. Tell us about some of the cons when it comes to these trusts.
So the first thing is everybody's a little different. And I'm sure you've talked about this on your program before. Everyone has different, you know, risk appetites, goals, et cetera. And so lumping everyone in together for something that everyone may have a bit of a different goal or overview for, it doesn't really make sense. Scholarship trusts or group RESPs are very, very conservative in nature. And that's one key example. All of your contributions and government grants go in, and they're typically invested in predominantly only fixed income or bonds.
Yeah.
And so for someone who has a long time horizon and wants to take some more risk to grow their money, this may not work for them. The other is,
and if we just put a dollar value on this, and we'll use simple numbers here, you could say that the long-term performance of the markets is, I don't know what number you'd use, say 5 to 7%, something like that. Yep. And over the last decade, the long-term performance for a GIC, for example, would be, call it 2 to 3. So you're already starting out with a significant gap in anticipated returns just because you haven't, you don't have a diversified portfolio, right?
Nailed it.
Well, there you go. All right. Maybe I should do this. So the first thing is the conservative nature of the investments. Another knock that I hear a lot from listeners on the trusts is the constraints. Like with a traditional RESP that's self-directed, you can put it in anything. You can take it out. You can add it in. Like there's a lot of freedom. Not so with the trusts.
Yep. It's essentially like a contractual obligation, and the assumptions they make and so on, that if you read the prospectus, it goes into detail. But when you opt into one of these, you are not really opting into just opening an RESP. You are opting into making those payments over the entire duration that your child is enrolled, which is basically from birth until they go to post-secondary, which makes no account for what if I lose my job? What if you're dual income household, but one of you passes away and now there's financial constraints. It doesn't really make any consideration for all of the life things that happen across the way.
And, you know, I can see how if you were to flip that the other way, you'd say, great, that's forced savings. It's like a mortgage in that way. It's forced savings. You got to pay that amount every month. But the challenge is, in order of priority, it's more important that you pay your mortgage and put food on your table, then save for a kid's education, as important as that is. Is that fair?
It is. And there's actually a little, now every group RESP or scholarship trust is a little different, but in some of the prospectuses that I've reviewed, I can tell you that they actually charge you interest on those contributions not made.
Right. So the third knock that people talk about, and this is what the listener pointed out, is the cost. So he had put in a total of 34 grand of his money, excluding the government contribution. And he asked what that amount would be worth if he were to withdraw it. And he'd been in it for, say, a decade. So you'd assume there was some appreciation, even in a GIC. And he was told that the number he'd get back would not be 34. It would be 27 grand because of the cost to administer those funds. How transparent are the trusts in terms of what those fees are? Because with any financial planner or a mutual fund, it's pretty easy to tell the price you're going to pay.
So it's buried in there. But I would say, based on conversations I've had with clients who've been introduced to a scholarship trust, based on stories I've heard from other people, or clients who have come to me from a scholarship trust, it's not transparent enough because there is an upfront fee. So I believe in the listener letter, they also denoted that in the first 2 years, they contributed and had almost nothing left over. And the reason is there is a commission that's charged and your money goes towards paying half of that commission first entirely. So for that first year, they weren't even investing. They were just paying the commission with those contributions. And then there's a fee to administer on top of that.
Now, part of the challenge here, I think there are two others that I would flag. One is that, I don't know if this is safe to say for all of them, but many of them are positioned as nonprofits. As you look at the prospectuses, am I right? Is that how they're positioned structurally?
Structurally, they are positioned that way. It's just that I think, like anything, if you pay enough away to other people in fees or salaries or things like that, you can still run a nonprofit by having paid everybody else too much money at the cost of the funds themselves.
Right. The other part is they have very effective marketing connected to births, right? So I used to work on Pampers diapers. We did a lot of work trying to target new parents as soon as that kid was born. They are also very focused on entry point marketing, more so maybe than the banks or the credit unions who have these lower cost, you know, more diversified type products.
And not only is the marketing focused on, I know your listeners said, you know, hospitals, but as an example, someone talked about signing up for maternity clothing, like a nursing bra. And, you know, they opt into the loyalty program. And then all of a sudden they got a call. The call was because the scholarship trust had access to that maternity clothing stores subscriber list. If you go to any of these light shows, fairs, you see that scholarship trust, you know, sign up to maybe win $50,000. That's opt-in marketing right there. So there's a handful of ways that they're active that you would not typically realize.
I feel particularly concerned, and I don't know if this is a fair concern for me to have, but I feel particularly concerned for newcomers to Canada, because when you look at it, I mean, certainly the government grant is super compelling, saving for your kids' education. It's compelling for everybody, but particularly, I think, people who are new to Canada, because they're, you know, starting afresh in some ways. How do you interpret those, the marketing focus and the demographic target?
So as someone who's been marketed to, like, I've had these conversations with scholarship trust employees when I was trying to figure out RESPs for my children. It's very effective because it's positioned as, well, everyone is doing it. Don't you care about your children? Don't you care about giving them their best foot forward? And many immigrants are very education focused. My parents are immigrants. Education was a big priority in our family. And so right away, for many of those people, it's going to tug on the heartstrings. And when you're sleep deprived as a new parent, combined with the emotional piece, it's a very deadly combination.
If I were to have, and we will have, leaders of scholarship trusts on, I'm ambivalent about it because I think there are pros and cons, but if I were to have them there, what would they tell me to rebut the flags or concerns that we have already outlined?
Well, one is those fees, those commissions up front. If you last all the way through, which not everyone does, right? People choose to leave or they withdraw. If you last all the way through, you get a portion of those fees rebated back to you in the form of a bonus. So that is one way that they often equalize for some of these lost returns or higher fees up front that we talk about. Now, what I would point out as someone who cares about the collective good is those fees are basically the fees of the other people who didn't make it through the program. So in a way, I'm making that money off of the backs of these people who lost their job or couldn't contribute at the right time. And many of these prospectuses will even go as far as showing the stats of saying, well, historically, typically 11% don't make it through the program, or 20% don't make it through. So it's all openly there.
Right. It's a good reminder that with another self-directed RESP, it's super easy to catch up. You can go pick up a year that you've missed up to a max. You can still qualify for that government grant. Okay. Just before we go, we've had all these knocks against the scholarship trust. I think we're aligned on our belief that a self-directed option is better. How does one do that simply? You can do it as soon as you've got the social insurance number of the kid, immediately.
Yep. And like you already talked about in the beginning, banks, credit unions, brokerages, or if you have, you know, an advisor who works with a custodian and can facilitate it at one of the independent firms, you go to them or you do it yourself. You put in the SIN number, you put in the birth certificate, and you open it and you can choose or get someone to help you choose any of the public investments available out there for you to choose from. Yeah. And then it's contributing as much or as little as fits within your financial plan.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we will say the 20% government grant tops out at $500. It's not going to be $10,000 a year. It tops out, but it is really simple to do in a low cost and diversified way. Thank you for your time and for having this conversation with us today.
Thank you so much, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Our topic was scholarship trusts. I'm a big believer in RESPs. Really, really, really. There's just cheaper, simpler, more flexible ways to do it other than the scholarship trusts. Our guest was Aravind Sithamparapile. He is an associate at Ironwood Wealth Management. Coming up next on Moolala, people are living longer than ever before, and it's having an impact on our retirement savings in particular. Darren Coleman, senior portfolio manager at Coleman Wealth at Raymond James, explains. And later, a car subscription service called Roam will speak with its founder and CEO, Apoorv Gupta. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, not to worry. You can head on over to moolala.ca, listen to past episodes there, and you can also search by guest name or by topic, so you choose the ones you want. You can also go to any of the podcast platforms out there, Spotify, Amazon Prime, wherever else you listen to those shows. Download it, write a review, or even subscribe. Moolala Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. 150 years old. Our next guest says that could happen. Like, a person born today could live to be 150 years old. Will it happen? Who would want that? And certainly, how would it affect your financial plan? These are all really, really important questions. Darren Coleman says the financial planning industry has it wrong when they consider the actuarial tables and how that relates to retirement savings. He is a senior portfolio manager at Coleman Wealth at Raymond James, and he joins us now from Oakville, Ontario, to talk about this question of longevity and whether it's 150 or 125, whether we have built sufficient buffer in our plans to account for that. Hello, Darren.
Hi, Bruce. Nice to see you.
Tell us more about this 150-year-old number. Where does it come from?
Yeah, so it's a big number and it tends to catch people by surprise, but it does come from some validated research. And if people want to look this article up, it's in the Harvard Gazette from January 2023. And it comes from Dr. David Sinclair, who's basically the head of biology and aging research at Harvard. And in the article, they talk about the fact that medical science has moved to the place where it's not unlikely that the first human to live to 150 years old has already been born. And that is an astonishing fact for most of us to begin to process, I think.
Yeah. Would you be up for 150? Because I'm good. Like, clock me out at 94. I am so done. Would you want to live to be 150?
Well, my family would argue that I'm still seventh sometimes, the way I behave. So age is an interesting construct, right? My knees might need a bit of work, but yeah. We have to get that idea in our heads, though, that we're going to live longer than we thought. And one of the things we talk to clients a lot about is understanding that their retirement is not going to be like their grandmother's retirement.
Yeah. I have a financial plan. In my financial plan, we have me fertilizing the earth or being a urn of dust at, I think, age 95. You're saying that in the financial industry writ large, they are not so conservative in terms of how long we will live. What are some of the benchmarks that you see?
Well, when you look at actuarial tables that the insurance companies provide, or you look for quotations as we would for, you know, life insurance or annuity products, the built-in assumption is that the average couple or the average person is going to live till somewhere in their late 80s. And that's an interesting number. If I go back to when I began my career in the early 90s, when people were 80 years old, they were old. Like, they had the shoes with the Velcro. They were old.
Yes.
You know, that great generation, right? And they'd seen a lot, lived a lot, and they were think about Golden Girls, right? That was the image. By the way, the actresses in Golden Girls were in their 50s.
Yeah.
Think about that, right? So, but now today, if you go to any pharmacy that has a section for birthday cards, there's not one, but probably several choices for happy 100th birthday. Mm. So these things didn't exist when you were a kid, when I was a kid. When you were in your teens, if someone turned age 100, two things happened. They got a letter from the Queen, and yep, the news channel showed up to show them blowing out either the one candle or the 100 candles if they had a smart ass son-in-law. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it was unusual. It was rare. And we thought that was, wow, 100 years old. That's incredible. Today, completely common. And so that number is going to keep getting moved out. And I don't think our industry prepares us for that. We have this construct of what retirement's going to look like. And there's these built-in assumptions. And one of them is you're going to be gone by the time you're 90. And I would argue, with the research we're seeing today, we're going to have to rethink that.
Yeah. How do you, what do you, what number do you assume? If you're writing a financial plan for a client, what number would you assume?
It's amazing how many people I have to talk into the idea that 100 is probably normal. They don't even see it coming. So I don't want to get into an arm wrestling match with people, but 100, and what's also interesting is some software doesn't allow us to plan for longer than that. That's also an interesting thing that, again, I see some of these assumptions built into software and compliance things that I think we're going to have to massage them and find a way to nudge them out a bit more.
I am currently reading Outlive, which is a longevity book topping the New York Times bestseller charts. And it talks about slow death versus fast death. And with a slow death, sure, we're going to live longer, maybe not to 150. We're going to live longer, but it may not be at our super healthy, you know, vibrant quality of life. When you get into more medical complications and more support required, the dollars involved are an order of magnitude higher than that image of the retiree, you know, sitting around their house and spending the weekend gardening. How do you factor that, what is it? Go, slow go, no go, a longer period of time in the no-go phase.
Well, and that's an interesting thing that we talk to clients about is that retirement, when they project it in their minds or in the software, it tends to look like a straight line, but it isn't. So for most people, they think, well, retirement will probably be front-ended with travel. Like as long as my knees work and my hips work, I want to do as much of that mobile stuff as I can. Then I'll probably settle down. Then I'll probably see my costs go up as I have people come and help me. So maybe that's the assumption. But I think most people need to really reflect on, well, what are my working assumptions that I've got? I don't even know I have them, but what am I thinking? And how often am I going to reassess this? Because I suspect you're going to see people live longer and more expensively for longer, because we're seeing people that are in their 70s and 80s and early 90s being way more active than they thought they would be. And they're traveling, they're enjoying, they're spending, they're having hobbies. Some of them are back to work because they want money, but they also want the things that go with work, which is social engagement, sense of purpose. All these things also become important. The other factor that we haven't talked about, but people have to be mindful of, is how old are your parents? Because you may be 80, but mom and dad may still be around when you're 80. That becomes a surprise. You weren't thinking that. You're thinking about yourself. What am I going to do when I'm 90? What are you going to do when you're 90 and you're still looking after mom?
Yeah.
How about that?
In today, you know, in 2024, we are in a period in which home prices are ridiculous. Lots of seniors who have owned their homes for decades are sitting on a whole pile of equity. How do you build that real estate asset into the financial plan based on your hypothesis that people are going to live longer and maybe that last chapter will be pricier than they thought?
Yeah. So when we do a plan with somebody, you have to look at not just what their investment assets are, their RIFs, RSPs, but what other sources of capital can they access and what techniques can they use to access them? So it's not uncommon where people want to stay in their home for as long as possible. Okay. So how do we sell your living room if we need money? Because I can't really do that. So how do we manifest that idea? And years ago, I've had this challenge with clients, and we used, this is before even things like reverse mortgages existed. So we had to get clients. And this is something where I think the banks are going to have to kind of figure out, how do I do underwriting on someone who's 83, doesn't have a job, but wants a mortgage? How am I going to do that? And it's because I have assets, I'd now like to find a way to draw from them, but I don't really want to pay you back very often. Like, how am I going to do that? So, because the banks, I would argue, their average customer is someone who's still in early family formation, buying their first home or moving up to the second one. They're not quite as advanced on how to do lending for someone who wants to stay in their home for a longer period of time and they're 87. How do I do that? Do I need a T4 from them? What's their gross credit score? These are things that I think they're going to have to learn to modify. And you're right. It often astonishes people how much it costs to stay in your home. And most people experience that when they're trying to pay for mom and dad. And they discover that $15,000 a month doesn't buy what I thought it would buy.
Yeah.
If someone has to come in and help.
Yeah. Yes. If you're looking for 24-hour care, it is just unimaginable. The kind of
cost, a couple hours a week costs a lot.
Yeah.
And actually on that topic, we also encourage clients when we do our plan with them, we have this this approach we take as a part of it. We talk up, down, and sideways. So we want to look not just at your plan, but let's look up a generation. So if you're a baby boomer, maybe you will have to be responsible for helping to pay for mom and dad. And then let's look at where your kids are, because we're seeing, you mentioned housing prices. A lot of kids are still in their basements of their parents and they're 33 years old. So that's a reality. And then look sideways. Who else in my family, my brother, sister, cousin, who may be able to help me pay for mom and dad, but who also may need my help? And in the pandemic, we saw lots of people that through no fault of their own, their business closed. Or like, what do I do? And they had to rely on their peers in their family to maybe support them. So I think people, when they do their planning, have to look beyond just themselves and look wider and above, down, and side. Who else might I have to help, or who else may be able to help me?
That's an interesting framework. Let me ask a supplementary question on that. How do you make priority calls? Because most people do not have anywhere near an infinite amount of resources.
Sure.
How do you make the call on, can I afford to support mom in assisted care at the expense of my own retirement or the support I'm able to give to my kids?
So it's interesting you ask that, because this is a conversation that many people are finding themselves in, and it's a surprise. And I think one of the best things we as advisors can do is help people get ahead of that, because surprises generally aren't good for most people. I know, hey, Santa's great, but apart from that, surprises aren't that much fun. And you're exactly right. This does become a decision-making process. I mean, it is about prioritizing multiple competing financial objectives. And there's no right answer. And I think the best people can do is go into that being prepared, understanding it's probably going to come. What are the other resources I can access? Who's involved in the conversation? And they may need a professional guide to help them navigate it. Otherwise, it just becomes people arguing with each other.
Interesting. Well, we'll see at the pickleball court in 2074. How's that?
I need to learn how to play that. I've heard a lot about this.
I got pickleball tonight. I'm not even ahead of the curve, but I am on that train, and I'll be playing till I'm 94, which is when I'm going to say
97. I'm going to wish you all the best luck.
Right. You beat 97. Darren, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate it.
Darren Coleman. He is a senior portfolio manager at Coleman Wealth at Raymond James. He also hosts a podcast called Two Way Traffic. And he was joining us today to talk about longevity and the thought that maybe people are going to live to be 150 years old. I cannot imagine. Coming up later, perhaps you don't want to be in a committed relationship with your car. Maybe you want a car subscription. What? Yeah. So it's not like renting a car for the weekend. It's not like leasing a car for 4 years. It's kind of something in between. This service is called Roam. It's a car subscription service founded by Apoorv Gupta. And we're going to talk to him on the show. But first, what it means to be a Henry, high earner, not rich yet. Andy Smith is our guest, executive director of financial planning at Edelman Financial Engines. He's going to talk about what you need to know about the term. And to stay up to date, Henry's or not, on all things Moolala, we have a newsletter. It is monthly, and it covers all the things that that we do here on SiriusXM, on CBC, CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, all that stuff. To sign up for it, you go to moolala.ca.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
What is a Henry? I'm not talking about O. Henry, like the chocolate bar. I'm not talking about celebrities a la Winkler who happened to be named Henry. I'm talking about an acronym that I actually hadn't even heard of before. It's High Earners Not Rich Yet. So those are folks with a household net worth that may be high. It may be like a wow to many people, but who themselves do not consider themselves to be wealthy. So we're going to school ourselves in this term and why people are feeling this way. Our guest is Andy Smith. He's the executive director of financial planning for Edelman Financial Engines. He joins us from Indianapolis, Indiana. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
Tell us more about the Henry. I mean, we've heard of, you know, double income, no kids, and there's all sorts of acronyms out there in the zeitgeist, but what's this one mean?
Yeah, so there's lots of buzzwords, you're right, that describe this group of people. So you talked about double income, no kids. There's this, quote unquote, the unassuming affluent. There's other people who are called kind of this, quote unquote, aspirational class. But these Henrys, right, they're high earners, not rich yet. So H-E-N-R-Y, high earners, not rich yet. And so these people who currently have pretty significant discretionary income and a strong chance of being wealthy in the future. So the issue with this group, though, is that despite earning salaries, you know, above the average, right, $100,000 or more, some of these Henrys can be pretty uncertain or get pretty uncertain at times about how they're kind of able to or what their plans for with achieving wealth going forward. So it's not so much, okay, I made it, I'm making a lot of money. It's all right, I've made a lot of money. How do I continue to take advantage of this moving forward so that I don't blow myself up in the process?
I started my career in marketing, very traditional packaged goods, you know, Procter & Gamble stuff. I'm quite used to market segmentation. This right. sounds like market segmentation. Is this how this term was coined? The marketers were like, what's going on with these people?
Well, I think that there's some of that. I think that, you know, by human nature, we all want to compartmentalize things as much as we can. And so it's like, okay, here's this. How do we go and talk to this group of people? Or from a marketing perspective or from a market segmentation perspective. All right, we've identified this kind of group of people. What do we need to do? How do we need to approach? How can we best serve these people? Because, as you know, everybody's different, right? Everybody's hangups, especially about money, are different. Some people have no problem earning it. They have all the problem in the world keeping it and saving it. Some people have no problem in the world saving it, but it's just, you know, they can't really last from one job to the other. So the issues are the same when you go group to group to group, right? High tax rates, elevated living costs, sometimes insufficient savings. So it really is trying to understand, where are you? How much are you earning? What are your kind of hot buttons? And then kind of helping them figure out what they want to do.
It would seem to me that there is a opportunity for financial advisors to target a Henry in that at a certain point, they could be a very, very profitable client.
Yeah, there's some of that. I think what we try to do is we try to step back a little bit and try to meet people where they are, right? So like I said earlier, everybody's different. And so when I talk with people, I'm trying to get a sense of, look, where are you right now? Where are you trying to be going forward? And so a lot of what we've actually started to find, we did a research study. It's called Everyday Wealth in America. And what we wanted to try to do was understand how people perceive wealth in relation to the world and the economy around them. So we'd looked at a lot of different topics. We asked them a lot of different questions. What we heard a lot, depending upon, you know, kind of where you were, age, how much you were earning, it was kind of centered around this idea of feeling wealthy. And so what we found was that a lot of people who felt that they are falling short of feeling wealthy, 67% believe that they'd need about $1 million or more to be considered wealthy. So if you think about that, it doesn't really matter how much you're earning right now. It doesn't really matter how much you're like where you are, or where you're living or anything else. If you think that you need $1 million or more to be considered wealthy, then it's a timeline game, right? Where are you? How long do you have to save? What sort of retirement and what sort of kind of longer term living do you want? And then meeting them where they are. So it could be any sort of approach, but again, you're trying to help people feel comfortable about where they are and where they're trying to get to.
How is this perception affected by the times we find ourselves in today? So there is global uncertainty, geopolitical drama in major markets around the world. Real estate is ridiculously expensive. How do all those factors affect what's going on in the present for people who would identify as Henrys?
Oh, it absolutely affects it, right? And it could be politics. It could be credit card debt. It could be the home buying that you're talking about. It could be the social media that you just feel absolutely compelled to check, you know, the second that you wake up in the morning, right? And you see all these people living all these wonderful, amazing lives, and you think, what am I doing wrong? It's absolutely a factor. So when you think about what it takes for you to feel wealthy, that idea, this concept of being quote unquote worry-free means different things to every different person. Some people are going to feel that they are worry-free when they can reasonably afford their children's college education. Other people are going to feel quote unquote worry-free when they think that they have a comfortable emergency fund to care for themselves or their family. Generally, what we have found is that living worry-free could include not having to worry about bills, not having that comfortable emergency fund, having a sustainable retirement fund, right? It's not just about having that magical $1 million. It's what are you going to do with that $1 million for what could be 10, 20, 30 years of retirement that are standing in front of you. But it's this idea of being able to maintain your preferred lifestyle without making significant financial sacrifices. You don't want to be old and having to sell plasma for hot dog money, you know, 10 years right. into retirement.
We talk to people at all levels of income, people who are barely, you know, scraping by, and others who've got gazillions, more money than they'll ever need. There is not a simple observation in terms of that financial anxiety. It's not like the people with lots of money have none and the people with very little money have it all. I know lots of people who got lots of money on paper, but still feel that anxiety. Could you talk a little bit about that disconnect there? That sure, there's the numbers and what they amount to on a statement, but that does not mean that people will relate to themselves as rich or wealthy.
Yeah, I think it has to do, or I think it stems from two issues. I think number one, it goes back to what your original kind of experience was with money as you were growing up. I talked to a lot of people, and they all have different sort of upbringings with money. Sometimes things were very tight and, you know, they weren't poor, but they really had to watch what was coming in, what was going out. Kind of, you know, vacations were few and far between. They worked all the way through college, had tremendous debt, you know, all the way out. Well, you're going to be hardwired to think one way about money. You know, people who have been through divorce, who have lost a spouse, who have lost jobs, or, you know, basically their financial situation was cratered, not of their own making, they're going to have a different way to approach how they feel wealthy. The other aspect of that is a lot of times what we feel or what we see is that people are uncomfortable about wealth because they don't know how it's going to work for them when the income stops coming in. So there's kind of work income, and then there's the bootstrapping, you're paying yourself, creating your own retirement paycheck sort of situation. Well, if you see all of this money on paper, but you don't know what's coming in, you don't know what's going out, you don't really know what you're invested in, you've never had to think about it before because your job was to just save as much as you could for as long as you could, you're going to feel a certain amount of angst, because you don't know how everything's going to work together. So when I talk to people, I'm trying to get a sense of where are you coming from? What has your experience been with money? But more than that, I try to ask them in a lot of different ways, what are you trying to accomplish? What do you want your longer term financial situation to look like? And then as I build these plans, I'm telling people, look, this is not a set it on the shelf and forget about it sort of thing. Don't pat yourself on the back that you've got this nice, you know, bound financial plan. This is a living, breathing document. And just because we are where we are right now doesn't mean that you're going to be spending that forever. It doesn't mean that taxes are going to stay the same. It doesn't mean that inflation is going to stay the same. So you ask about this uncomfortableness. It really has to do with kind of stuff that's years and years and years old, but some of it is absolutely in the present. Do you know where the money is coming and do you know where the money is going? And if not, be prepared to feel pretty uncomfortable for a time until you get that fixed.
There is the phrase, we are our own worst enemy. And when it comes to financial behavior, oftentimes that's it. There are certainly things in the environment that affect us, but a lot is within our circle of control. As you bring it back to the Henrys, the high earners, not rich yet. What advice would you have for people who are nodding their heads as they listen and say, oh, that's totally me. He is describing me. How would you advise them to move forward?
First of all, I would congratulate you being on where you are right now. So many people, you know, would love to be able to have these problems in terms of, all right, I've got this income. Now, what do I do with it? Mm. Then stop and really try to get your brain wrapped around this idea of saving as much as you can for as long as you can. It's fantastic that you have the money coming in, but at some point, the money will stop coming in. You are responsible for yourself. And you need to be able to save as much money as humanly possible. You know, again, you don't live like a monk. Don't just eat soup 6 days a week. But the idea is you have to plan for this future event. So in the present, I want you to save as much as you can for as long as you can. To get ready for the future, then, you need to be able to work with somebody. If you're comfortable doing this on your own, fantastic. But work with somebody that you can trust to figure out, where am I right now? What am I trying to accomplish? And where do I want to be in X number of years? And then you work backward using your income, using what you've figured out that you can save to figure out what that path looks like going forward, because you have to be ready. You have to plan for what's coming at you here coming in the next couple of years.
Really interesting stuff. Andy, thanks for making the time for us today.
Oh, you're great. I appreciate it.
Andy Smith, Executive Director of Financial Planning for Edelman Financial Engines. He was here to talk about an acronym I'd never heard of. It is called a HENRY, High Earner, Not Rich Yet. Stay with us. Coming up on Moolala, much more ahead, we're going to be speaking to Apurav Gupta, the founder and CEO of Roam. Get this, it's a car subscription service. So you like, it's interesting. You rent a car, but on a subscription. I'm the money columnist for Cityline, which is a lifestyle show on air across North America every single day. I share tips and tricks on earning more, spending less, slashing debt, talking about money with your family. Those segments are online at cityline.tv. You can search for me or search for like home decor or Mediterranean recipes. I don't know. That's probably more interesting than me. Moolala, Money Made Simple, is brought to you in part by MNP Debt, specializing in personal bankruptcy, consumer proposals, and debt help. They're Canada's largest consumer insolvency firm, and they've been around for 60 years. 60 years of experience helping Canadians break the cycle of debt. MNP has more than 80 local licensed insolvency trustees serving more than 240 resident satellite offices across the country. Your first step towards a debt-free future, sitting down with one of those folks, one of those licensed insolvency trustees, for a free confidential consultation. MNP Debt, life-changing debt solutions that work. Their website, mnpdebt.ca, mnpdebt.ca. Buying a car is really, really expensive. Some people choose not to buy it outright. Maybe they choose to finance it or lease it. Whatever you do, it's a costly commitment. And some people don't actually need a car long term. So if those are some of the options out there, it's interesting to note there's a new one. It's called a car subscription service. And there's a Canadian player called Roam. We're going to talk to the founder and CEO of the company. Apurav Gupta joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I am well. What exactly is Roam and how does it work?
Yeah, absolutely. Good question. And so Roam is a vehicle subscription company, and we essentially provide consumers with access to vehicles on a month-to-month basis. And we sit, you know, if you look at it from a landscape of what options you have available in terms of getting a vehicle, we sit perfectly between a typical daily rental and a long-term lease, right? So if a consumer is looking for a vehicle anywhere from 6 to 12 months, and they don't want to commit into a long-term lease or financing, and rentals may be very expensive, we are the perfect option for them. And, you know, the nice thing about our model is we also embed auto insurance, all the preventive maintenance, all your oil changes, along with the roadside assistance. So you're paying one price for all these services combined together.
Tell me more about your target audience, because I am clearly not in it. I have a 14-year-old. I just need a car. And I bought my car for cash outright a decade ago, and I will drive it into the dirt. So I'm not your person. Tell me more about your person.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a very interesting range of audience for this program. So we get a lot of newcomers that are moving into Canada, right? And they're trying to establish their credit scores, and the first thing they want to do is buy a house for themselves. So a lot of times, you know, they end up in a financing or leasing situation, and they block their ability to be able to get a mortgage, right? So we get a lot of newcomers who use our platform. You know, in addition to obviously preserving their credit score, auto insurance can be very high for these newcomers as well. So coming into our program, it becomes very cost effective for them. And obviously the flexibility of not having to commit for a long term is very attractive to them. So newcomer makes up a pretty big segment of our customer base. We also get a lot of one and a half car families, right? And this is a very interesting one. So during COVID, a lot of families sold their second or third vehicle simply because, you know, we were all working from home. No one really knew what was going on. So post COVID, a lot of them, you know, we had this huge vehicle shortage in the market, and a lot of them were waiting up to a year to order a vehicle. So when they realize that they have the ability to use a car subscription, let's say for 6 months, whether it's for the cottage in the summers or, you know, their ski and snowboarding trips in the winters, it became a very good option for a lot of families. So we have a lot of repetitive customers that, you know, they already have a vehicle in their household. They're looking for that extra vehicle for, you know, for seasonal use. So we do get a lot of those customers as well. And then the third bucket is simply expats, right? So snowbirds that, you know, are down south in the winters, and in the summers, they're looking for a vehicle for up to 6 months. And even, you know, Canadians that are living abroad that are coming back. So these are the three segments combined that we get a lot of repeat business from.
The comment about insurance struck me. So a newcomer to Canada, they don't have a Canadian driving record. They may have a harder time qualifying for a good rate on insurance. How do you factor that in? Because you actually have to insure across people with a real range on their driving history and their driving record, accidents and that stuff.
That's right. So I guess when a newcomer is coming into the country, a lot of times their previous record is either not counted, right? And they're considered what you call facility risk in the country. So a lot of them end up paying, you know, substantially more than individuals that are already living in Canada. So what we've done to help these individuals out is we actually look at their history from their country, right? So if someone's, they just moved to Canada, we'll typically look at their driving history from the country they're moving from. And obviously we still do a very quick background check. So we usually look at consumer's driving record, right? We look at a very quick look at their insurance history, and even a very quick check to make sure that, you know, we're putting safe drivers behind the wheels. But that's one way we make sure that every consumer has a fair way of getting a vehicle through us, you know, without being priced out of the market.
You mentioned credit score. Is credit score not a part of your process?
So we typically do a soft credit check, right? It's not a mandatory requirement. And what I mean by that is a soft credit check doesn't really show up in the consumer's credit profile. And we do not report the vehicle to the credit bureau either, right? So in the scenarios where customers are still new to the country and they're trying to build up their credit, that's typically where we'll help them build up their credit. But for consumers, you know, that are already living here, the vehicle is not reported to the bureau. Again, because of the short-term nature of this model, it's not something that we do as a company.
I surfed around your website. I looked at some options. So I have a sense for the monthly fee, the top up on the insurance cost. Tell us what consumers who haven't yet done that due diligence would see when they look at your site. What types of cars, what sort of monthly cost are they looking at?
Yeah, absolutely. So we carry everything from, you know, a Toyota Corolla all the way up to, you know, Mercedes, BMW, Audis, all the luxury vehicles, right? We do have a very significant portion of electric vehicles as well. So your Tesla Model 3s, Model Ys, and typically, you know, depending on how long the consumer wants to keep the vehicle for, our average monthly cost starts at $980 and goes up to $1,400, right? And that's inclusive of auto insurance and roadside and maintenance. So,
what's your model? How do you work? Are you like a Hertz who would buy a fleet, or are you leasing these vehicles, which then you are providing to clients in a subscription model?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the back end of this company actually works very, very similar to a rental model, right? So we do acquire our own vehicles as fleets. And then we typically hold these vehicles for roughly, 3 years. And in that 3 year period, we're subscribing them out to consumers that want to use them. And compared to a daily rental, we don't have hundreds of customers using the same vehicle. So in a typical life cycle, maybe we have 6 to 8 consumers using that vehicle, right? And then we would dispose those vehicles off. They are our own vehicles. And then we're just, we have a subscription agreement in the middle that allows consumers to use it.
This is a pretty rare model. It's not something a lot of people have heard of. As we look globally, which are the countries that are further along or furthest along in a car subscription world?
Yeah. So, car subscription has been around for a few years now. So, pre-COVID, I would say around 2017, we started seeing a lot of companies around the world. So in Europe, Germany, Netherlands, these countries are probably ahead, even the UK. And then the US, United States, we have quite a few companies that have been operating for the last 5 years, and they're growing pretty quickly. So it's becoming, an actual option for consumers when they're thinking about a vehicle, whereas with Canada, we're one of the first ones in. It's still a new concept. So we feel in the next 5 years, you're going to see a lot of movement in this space and a lot of companies also, entering the space and it'll be great. I think for consumers to have a lot more options, it'll be a great thing that'll happen in the next few years.
We have listeners from coast to coast to coast in this country. Can someone use Roam to rent or subscribe to a car in Inuvik?
Not at the moment. We would love to, we are expanding our service. So currently we are in Ontario. We are going to be expanding cross province this year. On the website, you'll be able to see which cities that we're looking at currently. But right at the moment, we're only based out of Ontario.
What would indicate someone for whom this really is not a fit for? Would it be someone who, has a couple of 16-year-olds in the house who are by any measure higher risk drivers?
Yeah, so we do. That's a good question. We do have minimum age requirements. So our minimum age requirement is 21 years, right? So so anyone below that, this would not be the right service for them. And, additionally, what I would also say is if someone has the intention of keeping a vehicle long-term, right? So if you want to keep something for the next 3 to 5 years, and we always tell them that leasing and financing is your best option, right? Because those are meant for consumers that want something long-term. But if someone wants something short-term and, they're not looking to get into debt, then that's where we fit in.
Accidents happen. We know this. Accidents happen. So someone's on a Roam subscription, they have an accident. What happens next?
Yeah. So, obviously all consumers are covered fully under our insurance policy. So if there's an accident, our team reaches out and we make sure that, obviously if there's anything happens in the vehicle in terms of injuries, like our insurance company takes care of it. And if there's anything wrong with the vehicle, if there's damages, then the insurance company covers it. Similar to an insurance company that you would have as a consumer, we do have a deductible on our policy. So the most that the consumer would ever be responsible would be for the deductible.
Right, which in your case is?
It's at $1,500.
It's $1,500. And what happens if there's a second accident in the real world, the world where you own that car, you've got an insurance policy, you might get a gimme on one, but you're not getting a gimme on two.
So yeah, if there's mistakes do happen again. So typically our threshold, anything more than three accidents, we're not able to take, we're not able to have that customer on our policy. Because we do look at the previous history, we do make sure that, everyone has the same onboarding criteria from our insurance providers. So yeah, if there's a first and second accident, obviously we look to see if it's at fault or not. If it's at fault, then we do have to get our, permission from our insurance provider. But if it's not at fault, then it really doesn't count. It wasn't your fault. So it really depends on the accident itself.
How many cars in your fleet today? And in a world of rainbows and unicorns, how many cars are in your fleet in 5 years?
Ah, that's an amazing question. I love it. We're currently north of 400 vehicles. And our target over the next 5 years is actually to hit north of 3,000 in Ontario. And, we're actively working on that. We've been growing year over year. So we're very confident we'll be able to get there.
Really interesting stuff. Thank you for joining us to talk about Roam.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Apoorv Gupta is the founder and CEO of Roam. It is a car subscription service. That's it for our show today. Thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca, so you can send us your your feedback, your story ideas, your questions, your comments. You can also subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. On any of the podcast platforms, you can subscribe to the podcast itself. And while you're there, leave us a review. On social media, I am at Bruce Celery on X, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. Thanks for listening and have a great day.